Beyond Brunel, talking about the future of infrastructure in the Southwest from the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest.
Welcome back to Beyond Brunel. In this episode, we're talking about electricity connectivity and capacity challenges facing the Southwest. It's all things grid today. Joining me in the studio is Emily Taylor, Strategic Engagement Officer at National Grid Electricity Distribution. And online, I'm joined by Mark Combs, Head of Environmental Partnerships and Climate Change at Cornwall Council. Welcome, Emily, and welcome, Mark. Emily, perhaps you can kick us off. What's the difference between electricity demand and generation?
We're all used to going to a light switch, turning it on, light being there, plug sockets. I think we forget sometimes, don't we, how much we use electricity in our lives. We take it for granted, which is brilliant because it means the electricity distribution companies are doing their jobs right. Your supply isn't interrupted, which is great. But demand is very much the electricity coming out to the customers. As at National Grid Electricity Distribution, we have 25 million customers across our four licence areas. So a lot of people relying on us for electricity. And it's quite a historic thing. You know, the electricity network was developed in the 1950s and it was very much coal-powered power stations produced electricity and we distributed it across the country. It was very much a one way. What's interesting with net zero is a lot of the pathways to net zero are looking at more electricity being needed. So when we talk about demand in this context of net zero, we're talking about needing much more. Depending on the pathway you look at, that can be anything from double the amount of electricity currently out to 2050 to maybe even four times the amount of electricity needed. And a lot of that's to connect low carbon technologies like heat pumps and electric vehicles and things. So when we talk about electricity demand, that's what we're talking about. You receiving electricity into your homes and your businesses. When we talk about generation, we talk about producing electricity and then putting that into the grid. So we are talking historically about those, that coal power station. That's how we built the network. But now, of course, we are seeing renewables playing a really important role. So onshore and offshore wind, solar farms, which you only have to drive up the M5, in any of our trunk roads, you see lots. And then also in the Southwest, we've got things like Hinkley, haven't we? So in order to achieve net zero, part of that is decarbonising the way we produce electricity. And therefore, we are needing to generate it in a way that doesn't use fossil fuels.
Mark, when we think about ageing infrastructure, we often talk about our railways or even our roads with potholes and so on. But I guess the same can probably be said for the grid. And I'm thinking about the fact that the West Country is rural and counties such as Cornwall are full of ageing infrastructure.
Yeah, I think it's a huge challenge as you look to whether it's the grid or, as you say, some of those roads and other infrastructure that we might need to think about updating, not just to deliver net zero, but in light of climate change and the impacts that we're already seeing on our infrastructure in terms of how we respond to increased flooding or drought, for that matter, at the other end of the spectrum. So I think how we look at planning our infrastructure improvements and the impacts that will have on carbon emissions and ability to deliver net zero, but also those wider impacts on the environment and other aspects of people's health and well-being as well, that could all be influenced by the infrastructure we have and, for that matter, the infrastructure we'll need as we move out to 2050.
Emily, you've spoken about demand and generation, but how's electricity changing? How's the grid changing in the Southwest?
I talked about the 1950s developing an electricity infrastructure, and it was very much one way. And we just produced electricity and we sent it out to people's homes and businesses. And that's what we did. The way it's changing now is that one-way flow can't be one way anymore. We're generating. So we're generating electricity on a massive level, but we also have got much smaller generation. So it's becoming a two-way flow. So if you think all the way down to people having solar panels on their own homes. So there's two things that are really happening in terms of the way it's changing. One is that people want to export electricity back into the grid as well as import it to power what they need. But we're also seeing that needing something called active network management. So them needing to be much, to do it effectively, much more monitoring on our electricity network. And that's a big change to how it has historically run. And with change comes a lot of planning and investment.
Presumably, Mark, change brings opportunity. I'm thinking about green jobs, green skills. How's that affecting Cornwall?
Yes, I think we see it as both an opportunity and a challenge. So things like the emerging technologies we've got in Cornwall, things like geothermal, which is great in the sense that it provides that base load of power. So it's 24/7 electricity generation, which helps with some of that grid management, whereas you don't have the intermittency of the wind and solar, as well as things like floating offshore wind. And we see those, as well as the more established renewables like wind and solar, is a great opportunity for Cornwall to increase green jobs and skills and help to overcome some of the barriers we've had with seasonality, low pay jobs historically. But also it is a challenge because Cornwall is literally at the end of the line of the transmission network that brings those big national power sources down to us. And then we have huge amounts of renewable energy being generated in Cornwall from wind farms, solar farms, but also increasingly, there was a report done recently that said 15% of all households in Cornwall are using some form of low carbon technology. So that might be generating solar or using heat pumps and the like. So we're seeing that as having a huge impact on what we can do. We had a real acceleration in the amount of renewables that were deployed in Cornwall. We generate about 37% of our electricity demand for the year from energy that's generated in Cornwall. That's causing problems because of that need to balance, as was just outlined, in terms of we're having to slow down the deployment of those renewables and even impacting on businesses and others being able to expand perhaps at the rate they would like to. So it's both a real huge opportunity and a genuine challenge that we need to work closely with partners like National Grid Electricity Distribution to look at how we can overcome that for not just Cornwall, but the wider southwest as well.
And I think we'll probably come on to the pace and the rate of change. But Emily, I just want to pick up on that point of the success of renewables. They're clearly having a really positive impact in the region. But I wonder, should we prioritise support for the commercial sector, or do you feel the domestic setting is where we can and should concentrate our efforts?
I hear, working alongside council colleagues, that it shouldn't be one or the other. It should absolutely be both. People that are extremely passionate, and rightly so, around achieving net zero. And we talk about 2050, but a lot of the councils in the southwest would like to achieve it by 2030. They're very ambitious. To do that, you can't choose one or the other. You've got to choose both. I think the challenge we've got in the connections arena at the moment is that there is a huge queue. So there's nationally 700 gigawatts of people waiting to connect generation to the network. We have to do that on a first come, first serve. That's the way we've been regulated. And there needs to be a lot of electricity network reinforcement, both at transmission and distribution level. So there's a huge amount of work going on to work our way through that queue and connect people as quickly as possible. But of course, particularly for the smaller scale projects, and we're not talking solar PV, this is anything above 1 megawatt, but perhaps a community. And in fact, there's a community in South Devon, they've got funding to put a wind turbine up. They've done a lot of fundraising. They've really a big fan of community action. But the connection dates they're getting back are 10 years from now. So yeah, it's watch this space here. You know, I think particularly for colleagues that might be listening to this and thinking we absolutely want to build generation into work that we're doing, it's just being mindful that it is a little bit stalled at the moment, but lots and lots of work is happening in that place to connect people as quickly as possible.
And let's just put some of that into context. So 700 gigawatts.
Yes.
What does that look like?
So that is, if we were to connect all 700 gigawatts, that means that's three times the amount of electricity distribution we'd need to hit the net zero target. So it's massive.
Yeah, huge.
Yeah. But within that, there are something called zombie projects. So there are projects that have applied to connect, but may have applied to 10 sites, with only ever having one intention of building in one site. It feels to me that nobody saw this coming, and it's come out of nowhere. And it's unfortunately, we're in a bit of a situation where it's got to be unpicked.
And something else you mentioned there also, Emily, was reinforcement. So what do we mean by reinforcement?
Okay, there's a lot happening in this space. Recently, there was a report that came out to say to do all the work that's needed on our electricity network nationally to decarbonise would cost £60 billion. So a massive amount of money. The electricity reinforcement costs have been socialised from April 2023. We all pay for them, something called a standing charge on our electricity bill. Historically, before that, the only way the network was reinforced at a distribution level was if somebody came along and said, I want a connection. And we'd look and say, okay, well, this needs to be done. You've got to pay for it. That's not the case anymore. We're all paying for it because of this importance of getting to net zero. But it does mean that, like with our public sector colleagues, we have to show value for money. We can't just go and build a whole new transmission line down to Cornwall, because it's absolutely what we'd like to do, but it's going to cost millions, if not £1 billion, to do that. So there are other options we're looking at, and that's buying electricity from local generation. That's something we call flexibility. It's a little bit like water, I suppose, but we don't always require max electricity. So most of the time we all bumble along, particularly in the summer, and we're like, oh, this is great. We only need, say, 50% of what our wires allow. It's that cold winter's day, middle of January, 5 p.m, freezing cold. We've all got our heating on, especially if we move to heat pumps, and we've all put the kettle on for a cup of tea. That's what we need to prepare for. And it's at those peak load times when it might be that we have agreements with local generation to pull in additional electricity, rather than having to reinforce the entire network, which of course likely to mean more pylons down all the way to, you know, Land's End, as an example.
And Mark, clearly it's really important to engage with communities on these topics, particularly as more communities are looking to generate their own electricity. And I wonder, are the issues around being able to feed that into the grid, is that disheartening? Are you getting feedback from the communities that you talk to?
Yeah, I think communities and businesses, and be they a small business looking to decarbonise, or for that matter, many businesses and residents are driven to put renewables, especially smaller scale, in to just reduce their running costs and reduce their bills. So I think we hear a lot of that and have done over a number of years. As I said earlier, we had that huge increase in Cornwall. So Cornwall generated about 8% of its own energy back in 2009, and that's gone up to 37%. And that was over 40%, but as we've already heard, because of the increase in demand for electricity through things like heat pumps or EVs, the amount of energy required has gone up. So the amount we're able to match has gone down. But we know that since probably 2016, that the amount of generation that's been added has really dropped, and that's across all levels. So we really hear that challenge, and we're doing a piece of work at the moment in Cornwall, working very closely with National Grid Energy Distribution, as well as Wales and West Utilities, as our gas network providers, to develop something called a local area energy plan. And that's really about mapping what the demand might be in different scenarios through to 2050, looking at how much energy we might need to meet that, and then looking at the different technologies that could be used to enable that to happen. And that's very much about looking at how we reduce that demand through things like energy efficiency measures or retrofitting of homes and businesses, as well as generating and matching that energy that's being produced with the energy that's required at different times throughout the year. And to do that, we've done a huge amount of community and stakeholder engagement to map out not just what might be needed, but also what people might be supportive of, and for that matter, what they perhaps wouldn't be. And one thing that's become very clear is that people see renewables as a real opportunity to deliver these benefits, but through things like community energy projects or local opportunities to own renewables, that there's a real opportunity to feel part of that and benefit from it, and goes beyond perhaps what often we might see in certain parts of the media, which is to say people are not supportive of these renewable technologies out there. And actually, about 75% of the people who responded to our local air energy plan survey, so that was about 3,500 responses we had from residents across Cornwall, said we should be doing more and we should be reusing renewable energy as a way of delivering that. So it is a real challenge, but a real balance as to how, where and when you kind of develop these renewables. Because as we develop our local air energy plan, that can be used by National Grid Distribution to evidence where they might need to reinforce or what they need to do. And then by having that community buy into that and endorsement of that approach through our engagement with residents. And we did something called a resident energy panel, where we had 15 residents from across Cornwall that represented geographically and demographically, so a good mix of ages and genders and things, to show what they were really supportive of, what they think we should prioritise. And along with giving our local air energy plan that endorsement and that backing, that will allow our members to support it when it goes for endorsement at our cabinet, and being used by National Grid Electricity Distribution. And it also can inform our local plan and the refresh of that, which will look at then if we've got something like geothermal, which has the potential to produce electricity and heat, can we zone an area around that to be a future housing estate where we could use the heat from the geothermal site to help heat those homes, or even for that matter, industrial use for heat That could be growing, leisure, or other uses. So we're really trying to use the local area energy plan to inform our planning process, but also our engagement with communities and businesses about what might be coming. And aside from that, it will show what are those investment opportunities as well. So it will say how many heat pumps we'll need, or how much more renewables, different types. And that helps, as well as giving a bit of confidence as the work that they're doing. It really unlocks opportunities for wider economic growth as well.
Beyond Brunel, talking about the future of infrastructure in the Southwest. From the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest. Search for us on LinkedIn.
Emily, clearly some really good stuff going on in the region. A lot of strategic thinking about these local area energy plans. I just wonder, do you think the public are aware of the work that's taking place? Because clearly there's some really good stuff going on.
No, is the answer. But I think in general, no, people go back to that. I walk in my house, I switch my plug on and electricity comes out. Behaviour change is talked about a lot. And I think particularly around low carbon technologies, there's an awful amount of work that needs to take place around encouraging people to get a heat pump or an electric vehicle. So if we take a heat pump as an example, if you've currently got a gas boiler and it fails, it is still far easier and cheaper to replace it with a gas boiler than go out and get a heat pump. So that's a big transition that as a country we need to go on. I'm imagining businesses are in a very similar position. And the same with an electric vehicle. They are far more expensive than petrol or diesel vehicles.
Mark, Emily spoke there about behaviour change. I'm conscious that we have seen massive change as professionals in our industry and the move towards renewables and so on. But do you think that we really adopt some of those principles as consumers?
I think it depends. Some people do. Certainly, I've found where I live, we were on oil and the boiler was due to be replaced. It was 20 years old. It was starting to fail. So I've taken those steps incrementally over to be able to make those changes. But I'm probably slightly more informed than the average person, the average consumer. And I think, using myself as an example, my wife would still challenge as to whether our heat pump is as warm as our oil boiler for the house and those sort of things. So there's lots of changes we need to make. I think the information is really important. And increasingly, what we're seeing is disinformation as well that's being spread. So as part of our consultation on that local air energy plan I mentioned, we had a number of people who were challenging me as to whether they were going to be sent to prison for not retrofitting their homes or things like that. So there's a real challenge we've got in terms of keeping it simple, but also making sure it's accurate.
Emily, presumably part of this is because of cost, in terms of the reason why we haven't adopted all of this new and emerging technology. Do you think that we connect enough with communities?
There's a role that suppliers have in this space in terms of, if I was to consider who has the most influence, as a start, National Grid Electricity Distribution, we don't have a lot of contact with customers. So we're probably not in the right place. That's why it's so great working alongside councils, because they are far more able to connect with their communities. So I think that's really important. The other thing with councils is they really understand their communities far better than we do. So firstly, that's a really important component. But suppliers, things like Octopus, they've got a real relationship as well. I don't know about you two, but I've certainly got an app which shows my electricity usage. And through that app, there are ways of encouraging me, perhaps with tariffs, to change the way I use electricity. Perhaps there could be offers or a reminder around electric vehicles or heat pumps. We talk about them a lot, but they play a massive role in this transition to net zero. And I think they already are, but I'd certainly like to see our suppliers do a little bit more to encourage behaviour change as well.
I think some of it, just to build on that, is around how we make it simple for people. So we found over time, we ran some early collective switching things of trying to encourage people to jointly switch their energy tariff. And this was almost 10 years ago now. But we actually found money, ironically, wasn't that big a motivator for people, because they felt it was just too challenging or too difficult. So I think making things simple and automating a lot of this is going to be really important for most people. Going back to the example of how we use it, we want to just come home and flick a switch. A lot of people don't want to feel like they're being told when they should and shouldn't do something. So I think the ability to automate things and use smart technology is going to be a really important part of the transition as well.
Absolutely. And some of it is around joined up thinking as well. So electric vehicles, I think there's definitely that fear of charging. I think Southwest is a really good and complex example there of not only have you got the people that live here and travel big distances and are very rural, that's a lot of electric vehicle charge points. So we need to be strategic about that. There's a lot of people working in that space. We connect you to the electricity, get the electricity into it, but there's also the companies that put the charge points in. There's the councils that own a lot of the council car parks, things like that. We all need to work together. There's the transport authorities. So yes, I think to make it a better sell, we have all got to join up and pull together as a region. This is bigger than any one of us. If we really want to hit net zero by 2050, we all need to be considering what we can be doing to get low carbon technologies into all of our work.
Mark, I just want to pick up this point again on local area energy plans. So presumably they're being rolled out not only in Cornwall, but across the region. How are they formed? Is that based on demographics? Do you consider location, educational requirements? Because, you know, education, based on our conversation just then, seems to be a really important part of this.
I think there's been a long-standing ambition to roll them out. Certainly if you speak to local authorities or to a degree the grid distribution operators and things, they would like to see these local energy plans being rolled out in a standard format across the country. And certainly as we move to more of a regional energy system planning approach to this, that they will become an important part. But actually to develop them is very time-consuming, very expensive, and that creates problems as a result. So there are not many areas that have got them as perhaps we would like. The early ones were not necessarily done in a format that allowed them to be used effectively as part of a planning process to inform the upgrades or things like that. And I think, you know, you can't go long in a conversation like this without coming back to government and government policy. And I think that's where we see a need for that consistent policy and funding around, whether it's local air energy planning, EV charging, household build standards, all those things. I think this new government has set ambitious targets for the electricity grid by 2030 again. So it's going to be really interesting in terms of how they develop policy to deliver that and what that will mean for us as councils, as businesses and as consumers to make these changes.
Emily, what role does forecasting play in planning for the future? And is it helpful to reflect on what we've done in the past?
Yeah, at the moment, forecasting is playing a huge role. It's basically clearly setting out how we are going to strategically invest in our network. It goes back to that conversation we had about reinforcement and flexibility. But lots of work is going on in the forecasting space. So one of those is that the energy system operator, so that sits under Ofgem, they create national pathways to decarbonisation. And then as distribution system operators, we take that and we work with local authorities. We look at things like local plans, local intentions for decarbonisation. And we take that national information and that local information, so top down, bottom up, and we create something called distribution future energy scenarios. And that sets out from now until 2050, every year, what we see the load increasing on our network. We're pretty certain where we think there's going to be a need for additional electricity. And then what we do is we put that through our network and see what breaks and when. And we then go to Ofgem and say, this is the investment we need. And hopefully we get the money we need and then we can invest in the network. The important key with this conversation today, having a council here, is that what we're very much trying to do is that future forecast. We are trying to build in that local area energy plan. So if we use the example of Cornwall, in a year's time, I would like to sit here and say that we are strategically investing in the Cornwall network based on what the local need is, based on their plan. And to me, that seems like a very joined up approach.
And Mark, inevitably, there'll be trade-offs between the additional energy infrastructure we require to meet our net zero carbon targets and potential impacts on national landscapes. So what might those impacts look like?
Yes, I think it's a huge challenge. In Cornwall, 30% of Cornwall's land is part of the national landscapes, which are formerly known as areas of outstanding natural beauty. And of course, that brings challenges in terms of they've got a mandate to protect and enhance the environment. And that brings challenges for development in whatever form that might be, and even the need to adapt the environment to respond to climate change. But we are seeing, so Cornwall National Landscape as an example, they're working closely with distribution and transmission networks to look at how you could plan for undergrounding of infrastructure. So rather than putting new pylons up, how can you take that underground, which of course has numerous other challenges that that brings, but that is part of the thinking, that how do you bring these things into the landscape without too much impact and doing that in the right place. So yeah, it's a huge challenge, but something we're going to have to tackle.
Absolutely. And just to come on from that, it's a challenge because arguably people don't want loads of new pylons going up, but the same goes with generation. Do people want onshore wind now the ban's been lifted? Do they want a big solar farm on their doorstep? So yeah, it's really difficult, but also it's the time it takes to put that new infrastructure there. That doesn't happen overnight. So building a new transmission network or something like a new grid supply point in Cornwall could take 10 years. And it's whether that then stops us getting to net zero by 2050. So I think there's so much going on to look at alternative ways. Talked about flexibility earlier. Microgrids gets mentioned. But yeah, it is an ever-changing landscape as to how we can generate and use electricity locally.
I think that was an interesting thing, that when the original pylons went in or were built, they were seen as progress because it was about bringing electricity to homes and unlocking the potential of that, whereas now it's seen as a blight on the landscape, as are a number of the different renewable technologies as well. And when you consider wider land use challenges for food and for environmental recovery and nature recovery, those are all things we have to balance off. In Cornwall, we talk about our triumvirate, or our three-pillared approach, which is our response to the climate and ecological emergencies and the need to adapt to an order changing climate. So we consider that in all of our different policymaking ways to try and I emphasize to try to balance those different competing priorities that might be out there.
And Mark, Emily's mentioned these zombie sites, these zombie projects, which seems like a bit of a strange term, but of course, completely understandable if you've got plenty of planning applications being submitted for connections where you've got generation points. Is that something that the council can be working more closely with the grid in order to try and whittle those out as part of the planning? We know that there's potential reforms on the way. How might that work in practice?
Yeah, I think that's going to be interesting. I would say we, for a long time, had a good working relationship with, I always want to call them NGET, we shorten that. Grid electricity distribution to NGET when we talk about it. So apologies if I slip into that. But yeah, I think we've always had that close working relationship with them, and we would continue to look at how we can evolve that moving forward. But we do have an important role as a planning authority to look at what's going on. And I think it's more about that joined up, how you join up the approach. So there are certain things that a developer would need to hit to keep their grid application live. But then once they pass them, they stay live for another prolonged period of time. And that could be something like getting planning permission or certain parts of planning permission enacted, even if they haven't got funding to build it out, or vice versa in some cases. So yeah, I think it's got to be a joint approach, and then helping to inform, as we said earlier, using the local player energy plan to inform the local plan to really be able to inform where that reinforcement work or things, or even the standard of the homes we build, to reduce the demand and help that balancing out. But yeah, moving some of these zombie projects on that we've been on for 10 years, some of them, because there was a huge boom with the subsidies that have since been removed, meaning that some of those projects won't be viable any longer, I would imagine.
Mark makes a good point there about it's a two-way process, really. We've talked a lot about the need for increasing electricity, more electricity, more electricity. But, you know, planning and the local plan and new homes, there's a lot to be done in that space in terms of making sure those homes are already retrofitted or already as efficient as possible. And I'd say homes, but I'd say anything we build now, if we can, what can we do to help it need as little electricity as possible? Because that will, in time, massively help, you know, the need for reinforcement of our network.
And Emily, when we talk about these zombie sites, these sites which are aspirational but potentially impractical or don't have the financial backing, presumably that has a massive impact on productivity.
Yeah, what we're moving more towards is something called shovel ready. So rather than first come, first serve, and you didn't have to hit a lot of milestones, as Mark said earlier, they're going to have to show that they've got funding at some point quite soon, and they're going to have to show that they've got planning permission before they're even given a connection request. So that is going to come in, and that'll be for all the new schemes. The problem I think we've got is still sorting through all those schemes that have already been given connection requests. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I think if anybody was to do it again, it would have been changed much sooner.
Emily, when we talk about green energy, we know a mix of different energy sources will help to increase the diversity and the security of our supply, but presumably different generation types require different grid connections.
Yeah, what requires different grid connections more is the size at which it's connecting. Things like personal generation, but very small scale, so solar PV on someone's home, that's quite easy to connect, and we will connect that within weeks, if not days. Then we get up to slightly bigger generation, which might be just a small solar farm in a field. That is still relatively easy to connect. We've talked a lot about some of the connection challenges at the moment. They tend to sit where it's 1 megawatt or more. So you're looking at quite a reasonable size solar farm for that, or a wind turbine. And it's those larger scale projects where we're seeing some challenges. It'd be really good to say at this point, though, that I'm very proud of the Southwest, but I think we're punching above our weight with generation. You know, we've got a lot of natural resource, especially if the floating offshore wind comes on board. Cornwall certainly generates a real mix. But I was chatting to a Somerset colleague last week, and they've got an incredible amount of solar. I don't know if anyone's ever driving up the M5, but you see the Morrisons Distribution Centre on the left, and you see the new solar farm, which is 50 megawatts on the right-hand side. So yeah, we are definitely making the most of our natural resources down here. And it would be lovely to say we could generate all our electricity. And then, of course, you've got Hinkley coming on board as well.
Well, I think we can all agree that South West is best. We've said it before, but we've said it again. It's such an important discussion for the future of the region. And of course, this has implications for us all, a topic that we'll inevitably return to in future episodes. Thanks again to my guests today, Emily Taylor from the National Grid and Mark Holmes from Cornwall Council. Please join me for another episode of Beyond Brunel soon.
You've been listening to Beyond Brunel from the South West Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE South West. Search for us on LinkedIn. Beyond Brunel is presented by Christopher Ackland, a Fresh Air Studios production.